We're going to continue now with Locke's political theory, and I had left off by telling you that Locke thought that there were ethical debt slash legal principles that all people just knew intuitively. And these, he thought, were the basis for law when a state is formed. But people were originally, in his view, solitary. Now, he didn't think that they were necessarily poor, nasty, brutish, and short, but he did think that humans had come individually into the world, and each individual was a sovereign over his own life. He was king of his own, his or her own bodies and what they do with them and so on. But there are these ethical constraints. And so he argues that there is a natural law that known to everybody intuitively. And this natural law is a law in the state of nature, where state means the condition of nature. Since all people are equal and independent, no one ought to harm another in his life, health, liberty, or possessions. Everybody intuitively knows that. And notice I made the distinction up here of the term state, meaning a condition. It means both things in English, right? It means the condition someone's in, when you, or something is in, is when I come in to my grandchildren's bedroom and I say, "Whoa, what is this place? It's in a terrible condition." That means a state of affairs, all right? But the second meaning is that it's a social institution, and that means it's an organization formed for around a specific purpose. And the state, as that had come to be used, was the social institution that administers justice. It makes a public legal order and enforces it. That's that and protects from foreign invasion. Now, Locke's theory then is that although humans came into being, he knows not how. I mean, whatever transpired between, and God created man in his own image, male and female created he them, to now we have a lot of people on a certain landscape, and they're all sovereign individuals, and they're all trying to preserve their own lives. But that means, without creating a civil society, that each person has to defend him or herself, has to make his own clothes, to make his own house, find his own food, and so on. So they're all in competition. But he thinks that because they know this natural ethical law, they need not be in conflict. So it's not, as Hobbes had said, that in among human society, everyone is at war with everyone else. No, that... Locke thinks that's not true. Happily, it's not that bad. So he wants to talk about how a state gets established. And for Hobbes, it's not that because people are all in this desperate situation of being solitary, poor, nasty, and their lives being short. It's because it's a great inconvenience to have to avenge every wrong done to you. So you may be getting along fine, and you have a decent farmland that feeds you, and you have enough cattle that you have meat, and you have skins to make clothes for wintertime, and so on. And somebody comes along and robs you, or kills a member of your family. There is no public legal order. There is no public legal institution. There are no police to go after this guy. It means that you, as head of the household, joint head of the household, whatever, you have to arm yourself and go after the criminal. And if you don't, then you're going to be made a target for all criminals. If you don't go after this one and get him and punish him, and then you've made yourself a target to every other criminal, and they're all going to come after you and rob you and kill you, members of your family, because nothing's going to happen to them if they do. That is a major inconvenience, and Locke says that's the kind of thing that drives men to make a state. And after that, his account gets much like Hobbes. Therefore, people with property that needs to be protected, with a family that's now large and some members of it are very vulnerable, they're just children or they're elderly, then that's the sort of thing that makes them get together and say, let's form an institution that's going to make public a legal order and have the power to protect it. So what happens is that all the people who sign this contract, and for Locke, that's really a contract. They're going to write it up and they're going to sign their names at the bottom, and they are going to pay taxes every year to support it in order to keep the people who work in it supported. And that means judges. It means some kind of supervisor who sees to it that the law is being observed in a certain area. It means money for courts and judges. It means money for police. So some kind of military force is going to have to be formed. And that's what's going to go after the criminals, not you or me. We don't have to stop everything and wreck our projects and neglect our farms and our families to go away and try to hunt down someone that we may or may not be able to find. And we're going to pay enough taxes to this new institution that its police force is going to have the money to track people down, and without taking time away from the lives of the people who have contracted with it to protect them. That, in short, is Locke's view of how the state comes to be formed. There's a lot left out of this, however. What exactly is the relation of the state, well, first of all, to the people? The people who sign on say, yes, count me a citizen. They're agreeing to pay taxes, and they're agreeing to have laws made, and they're agreeing to having them enforced, and they're paying to have them enforced. But what say do the people have in what laws get passed? That's not altogether clear. It's rather obvious that Locke assumes that something very like the British parliamentarian system will arise. That is, the average person will have membership and citizenship in the state as a social institution. Average people must be given some say in lawmaking. What kind of laws are we going to have? And it's going to have to be that once the laws are established and the police force is established, that this police force also protects everyone from foreign invasion, enslavement, for example. So this becomes a national. That is, these people are now a nation bound together by a legal contract. And they sign over their naturally born right to defend themselves to the sovereign, who operates according to laws and utilizes the armed force put at the disposal of the sovereign. That sovereign may be an individual, it may be a committee. Locke's not too clear about whether you have to have some specific form of government as he is about these basic questions. But it's odd then that he doesn't address really clearly what relation this newly formed institution with the power of military coercion has to families, state, businesses, schools, churches, labor unions, hospitals, and we can go on and on. There are all kinds of institutions in a society. So, what's the relation of the state to them? And he goes on to urge that the state should be restrained in the way it uses its power. But it comes out in the end that the state exercises legal power over all the other institutions of life. And that means that Locke subscribes to, or at least does not oppose, what I call a hierarchical view of society. So society is a hierarchy, with the state at the top. This is supposed to be a crown. The state makes laws and exercises its power not over all the individual members of the society, but also over marriages, families, schools, churches, anyway, that says churches. You can correct my mistake. Businesses. Labor unions. They weren't called that in Locke's day, but they had them. They were called guilds. And so on. All other institutions. All are subject to the legal making power and military enforcement of the laws. I'm calling that military because it means that if you violate a law, someone who's armed with a weapon, or more than one person armed with a weapon, comes and gets you. You're arraigned before a court, you're held for trial, and so on. In England, the idea of a jury of your peers had gotten its start when the barons threatened to charge King John if he didn't sign the Magna Carta. That was 1215, so it was very old when Locke comes on the scene to write, and he assumed some form of trial by jury of the peers and so on. But that wasn't universally true. Spain didn't have juries. It had a panel of judges that heard a case. Mexico's still that way, for example. And it's not obvious to me that one of those is that much better than another. I can think of circumstances under which I would prefer to be tried by a panel of judges who knew the law than 12 randomly selected people off the street who may or may not know anything at all about what the concern is that I've been accused of. Just let that go. But for Locke, we have this hierarchical view. Society is a hierarchy. And it's significant that he puts the state and its lawmaking and its coercive power above the church as well. If you know anything about medieval society, that was a great controversy that threatened to tear society apart. Thomas Aquinas had written that the authority of the church is above the authority of the state. And what had been worked out in most countries of Europe is what was that the government, the state, acknowledged the that the church acknowledged the divine right of kings. That means the church is going to acknowledge that so-and-so, who is now taking on the throne, is the next nearest relative of the last person to have that authority. And that's that determines the order of succession to the throne. And that's recognized when the church says, well, that shows that God chose this man, and the church consecrates him as king. And by the same token, the king acknowledges that the church is supreme in moral matters and everything that affects the soul. And the church acknowledges that the state is governor of the people's bodies and everything temporal having to do just with this life. It sounds tidy, but in practice it was anything but. And controversies went over many different issues as to whether that was the authority of the church that should prevail or the authority of the state and so on. And anyway, what happened in Britain to that controversy was ended as a controversy by Henry VIII. So by the late 1530s, Henry had declared himself and all successive kings or queens to be head of the church. And the king would appoint the bishops, not the pope. We're not going to be ruled by someone in another country, is the idea. And Locke certainly goes along with that. He does nothing to try to overturn that. Well, there were still people, of course, who believed that it's the church's authority that should be supreme. And there were people that cursed the church and wanted the state to be supreme. And Locke comes down on the side of the state, but gently. He doesn't want to seem to be putting down the church or accusing it of anything. He just wants to say that it's law, the state's laws can preempt church practice. He puts it this way. It's absurd that things should be enjoined by laws that are not in a man's power to perform. To believe that this or that is true doesn't depend on our will. The business of laws is not to provide for the truth of opinions, but for the safety and security of the commonwealth, and of every particular man's good, of every particular man's goods or person. And so it ought to be, for the truth certainly would do well enough if she were left alone to shift for herself. In the case of each man's salvation belongs only to himself. That's a very Protestant thing to say. The Catholic thing to say then was, each man's salvation belongs to his relation to the church. Anyone may employ as many exhortations and arguments as he pleases toward the promotion of another man's salvation, but all force and compulsion are forbidden. Every man that has the supreme and absolute authority of judging for himself. That's a very Protestant attitude. And I can tell you exactly where it comes from. In a work called On the Babylonian Captivity of the Church, 1518, Martin Luther raises this question very sharply. What gives one Christian person the right to make a law that binds what other Christian people can do or can't do? All are one in Christ. According to the passage that says that in Galatians 3, not only are all one, but it doesn't matter if you're slave or free, Greek or Jew, it doesn't matter if you're male or female, all are one. This implies a kind of equality, Luther says. So what gives any one the right to make laws that bind another? And he raises that issue three different times in the essay, and three different times he gives the same answer. No one can be bound to a law made by another except by his own consent. This is law and public legal order provided that the people consent to being ruled by that law and public legal order. Now, what Locke adds here is that there's an actual contract he wants to see drawn up between the people who are going to be protected by his voluntary state and the people who won't sign up and won't pay the taxes. Then they're not protected. Locke even thinks that it ought to be the public policy in England and elsewhere that everybody gets a chance to sign this. You actually get a document sent to you that you read and you sign your name. And if you don't sign your name, you're not subject to the tax to support the state. If you sign your name, you are subject to the tax, but you get the benefits of being a citizen protected by this state, this public legal order, and public legal enforcement. So if your house is set fire or you're robbed, a member of your family is murdered, and you have not signed on as a tax-paying citizen of this artificially made state, it's up to you to do something about it. Nobody's going to lift a finger to go after a criminal. That's Locke. He thinks of the state, however, as pretty much what we would call laissez-faire. Let things be as they are. The state will not be actively looking for trouble, but when petitioned about a wrong done you, about a robbery, about a murder, about a fraud on a contract or whatever, then the state will act. Now, he makes it clear that this includes the state's supremacy over the church too, which is a really important one since there have been so much argument and fighting over it in the Middle Ages. Suppose this business of religion were left alone, and there were some other distinction made between men and men on account of their different complexions or the color of their hair. Can it be doubted that these persons, distinguished from others and united together by one common persecution, would be as dangerous to the magistrate as any others? So he doesn't want to see these controversies come up because the state is going to have the power to end them. You'll say that assemblings and meetings endangering the public peace and threatening the commonwealth could still undo my ideas, here is what he's saying. But if this be so, why is not the magistrate afraid of his own church? And why does he not forbid assemblies as dangerous to government? Let's therefore deal plainly. The magistrate is afraid of other churches but not his own, because he's kind and favorable to the one but severe and cruel to the other. So let him turn the tables. Let those dissenters enjoy the same privileges in civilian matters, in civils, as in his subjects. And he will quickly find that these religious meetings will no longer be dangerous. But then he gives an example of a case in which the state has every right to interfere. He says, suppose people have as a right in their religion the sacrifice of animals. He says anybody has the right to slaughter an animal of his own, whether for food or for religion. And that doesn't go away because he meets with other people who believe the same religion and slaughters the animal in order to put it on an altar and burn it as a sacrifice. But suppose that in the whole country there had been some disease sweep through and kill most of the cattle. And it was really important now to bring the cattle back as a source of food and so on. And so the civil government could say no more slaughter of animals for any reason, because that's needed by the commonwealth. And they would have the right then to impose on what would otherwise be a person's religious liberty. Man that has a cattle can dispose of them as he wishes, if they're his property. But if the state has need of it all, it can forbid that. So it's about as clear as it can be. The state has the final say. The state makes the laws, the state enforces the laws. The church can have its own moral rules and so on. It's set up conditions for being full members of the church. It can teach that unless you're a full member, you're going to hell when you die or something like that. It can do all that at once, but it's going to conform to the laws of the Commonwealth. That's Locke. And I remind you again that Locke said nothing about doing away with the hierarchical view of society as a whole. But there are individuals that make up all sorts of different institutions of society, social organizations, call them marriage, family, school, business, union, church. We could toss in hospitals, political parties. We could keep on going. And then there are the institutions that are less organized, but still exist. They exist by free association, things like a book club, a sports team, so on and all. But the state is supreme over all. Now, I raise this in order to get you to think about, as I've tried to do in the other major points in Locke's philosophy, what should a Christian say about this? Not to deny that Locke's a Christian, he was a believer. But he didn't think that there were uniquely Christian views of everything, or if there were, surely the church had come up with them in the Middle Ages. I beg to differ. And I want you to consider an alternative political theory, one that was made up and argued for by a particular individual. The individual I'm talking about is Abraham Kuyper, who lived from 1837 to 1920. Kuyper was a remarkable person. Kuyper was a scholar, and he was a pastor of a congregation for a while. And then he founded a Christian political party, a Christian university, and a Christian labor union. And then he was elected prime minister. So he was prime minister in the Netherlands around the time Teddy Roosevelt was president of the United States, early 1900s. He died in 1920. Well, what he proposes is not a hierarchy. He says the real view that a Christian ought to be taking here sees society this way, sees every individual as living his or her life, with respect to different social concerns. One of these is education of the young. Another of these is the maintenance of justice. Another is the maintenance of health. Another is for other institutions are for the promotion of art. And of course, there are churches, synagogues, mosques, temples devoted to the preservation and promotion of the faith, of faiths. And we get other things as well. Of course, there's the economic concern. And there we have both the institutions of businesses by which someone earns a living, banks that provide a way for people to save money and get loans, there's the stock market and so on. So there are all these different major concerns of life, and humans create institutions, social institutions, that correspond to them. They correspond to them in the sense that those are social institutions that are made in order to promote and preserve the concern, the interest, this aspect of life. So art for art, there are schools, there are things like orchestras, dance companies, and so on. For protection of health, there are things like clinics, hospitals, emergency services. For the promotion of justice, there is the state and the ruling organ in the state is government. So all of us are citizens of the state, but not all of us are officials in the state. We all get a vote and we elect representatives. The representatives are officials in the state. Whether that's president, the governor, whatever we want to call it. And that has to do with the promotion and preservation of justice in society. And for the promotion and preservation of faith, there's church, synagogue, mosque, temple, whatever name it wants to go by, ashram. For education, we make schools and establish them. And for economics, there are businesses, unions, banks, so on. And there are a lot more concerns to life, too. I didn't fill out the whole circle. And institutions are created for their promotion and preservation. There's another way to think this, come at it from a slightly different angle. There are all different sorts of authorities in life. Scripture tells us that parents in a family have an authority in the family. And one of the Ten Commandments is honor your father and your mother. That's the first authority anyone encounters. Of course, it means any legitimate authority, but it takes the immediate and obvious and most prominent example in the lives of everyone is their parents, the first authority they contact. So there, but there's an authority in a business too, the owner, the people that put up the money that gets the business rolling. Ownership confers authority. This is what product or service we're going to offer. Here are the salaries we're going to offer. Here are the prices at which we're going to offer to the public these products or services. There's authority in the labor union. There's authority in a family. I didn't even put that down, did I? There is human reproduction. And there's the family. The authority in the family is the parents, not the children, it's the parents. And if you think that what I ought to be saying there is that the husband is the supreme authority, then I think you understand those verses of the New Testament incorrectly. It means what they say is the husband is the head of the family in the sense that Christ is the head of the church. It doesn't make him a big boss. He gets to tell people what to do and impose punishments and ostracization. No, it doesn't make him the boss over his wife. And as Calvin commented on those texts, it doesn't mean men are superior to women. It's the religious concern there. The husband is given the ultimate religious responsibility for the welfare of his family. Religious authority only. But anyway, we have a very different view of society. Notice that what's in the center of this circle is the individual person. Every individual person is a member of some family, has some concern for art, certainly has a concern for his health, wants to see justice enforced, may or may not belong to an organization that promotes a faith. But I would say it doesn't matter whether a person belongs to some one of those organizations. Everyone has some faith or other. Everyone, by the values that they accept and the way they live their lives, shows that they presuppose something or other as the self-existent reality that creates all the rest. That, so they have something that in their scheme of things is divine. And that's a religious belief, whether they want it to be or they don't. And whether they practice anything or they don't. Remember, there are major religions in the world that do not practice worship. Brahmin Hinduism, Theravada Buddhism. So worship is not a necessary hallmark of religion, religious belief or practice. But anyway, come back to our non-hierarchical view of society. Each of these are the institutions that is created by humans to promote and preserve the interest it corresponds to. Or by interest, I don't just mean money interest. I mean that people have a natural interest in justice. They have a natural one in art. They have a natural interest in having their children educated, and so on. Then those natural interests are fulfilled by the creation of the institution. I don't think humans have ever had some kind of a social life interest and not created an institution for its promotion and preservation. And the same thing is true about justice. Something is equal to a state. An institution that creates an order of public justice and enforces it. What's different in a primitive society, it occurs to me to use this illustration here, in a primitive, say, tribal society, the difference between that and, say, the nation states of Western Europe and North America, the difference between them is that in the tribe, everyone functions in all of those interests. And the chief may be the one who assembles the wise of the tribe and seeks their advice in different issues and so on. But there's no distinct group of people who are experts in the law, in art, in education, in doing business with other tribes, and so on. So that's just what we regard as primitive. That is, they haven't differentiated these different interests and authorities clearly and devoted a specific institution, that is, group of people expert in that, to promote and preserve that interest. But in our modern society of, again, Western Europe, of, well, it includes Asia too, certainly includes China and India, they have a state, which is the government, and they too grapple with the problem, what should be the relation between the law-making and enforcing institution and all the rest of the institutions of society. And generally, what they have is a hierarchical view. Now, this other view, this non-hierarchical, non-hierarchical view arose in the Calvinist revival movement, of which Abraham Kuyper was an important and influential member. So he's claiming that this view is something closer to what Scripture would lead us to conclude than the hierarchical view is. So this is a theory. It's a theory of government. It's a political theory. Nobody's denying that. But it's at least inspired by things in Scripture. For example, Scripture looks with approval on the idea that the owner of a business has authority in the business. It looks with explicit endorsement upon the proposition that parents are the ruling authority in the family. It looks with specific endorsement that clergy are the ruling body in the church. It looks with specific endorsement about a number of other things. So what Kuyper is doing is hearing that and saying, wait a minute, why? Maybe that's the way to see the whole of society. Many different interests need to be preserved. People live their lives in all of them at once. I am at once the child of some people, the parent of others. I do business with these following businesses. I was in a business myself. I was a college professor, so I was busy in education. That's another interest that everybody has, having the next generation educated. Even in a primitive tribe, there were teachers who instructed the young. Usually it was the father of the family instructed. So they didn't differentiate education as a specific need and create an institution devoted to it, but all people took part in it. Notice again that in this non-hierarchical view, the segments of the pie are not groups of people. All people function in all of them in their lives. The person is in the black dot in the center. Every person's concerned about their health, has some concern for art. They may not be an art aficionado, but when they go to buy a car, they think one looks better than another. They go to buy a dress or suit of clothes, they get one rather than another because they like its style better. That's an art judgment. Probably both pieces of clothing will keep them warm enough, or cool enough, or modest enough, whatever the concern is. But it's an artistic judgment then. Everyone's interested in some education. Doesn't have to be formal. Being an apprentice to someone is just as much an education as going to a college. So someone can be apprenticed to a plumber or an iron worker, a welder, a house builder, be a master carpenter. All that kind of thing is also education. A skill, a trade is passed on. I actually did that for a while. I had so many different jobs trying to work my way through school that one of them turned out to be apprentice to a man who tuned and repaired pipe organs. That's pretty esoteric. And while working with him and observing what he did that I learned to tune pianos. And later on, I put myself through seminary giving music lessons and tuning pianos. You know, people don't readily think of those as ordinary occupations. They're not ordinary. But they're learned by apprenticing. That's education too. And sometimes it's even better than going to college. Remember, Abe Lincoln became a lawyer, never went to college. He apprenticed to a lawyer for years, and he learned enough that he passed the bar exams and became a lawyer himself. Look again at the circle. The interest, for example, in the faith. Indian tribes or primitive tribes would also have a religion, the tribes' gods and so on. And sometimes they did have a particular person who was expert in that. And he was called the medicine man or the spiritual man. Actually, the way of Western Europeans interpreted that, those terms from the Indians, often obscured what they really meant. It wasn't medicine, it was spiritual man. And the man who called Crazy Horse. That's again, it's a bad translation. It's inspired by the divine horse. Not crazy, but inspired. And sometimes there were specific people who had visions and believed themselves to be more in contact with the gods than the average person. Then they're made to be one of these spiritual experts. So as society became more differentiated and larger, we have people devoted as experts in these fields and who therefore become eventually authorities in an institution created to preserve and promote that interest. And this view, says Piper, is more Christian then, because it overhears the way the scripture sees these different authorities as all applying to human life at once. It's, again, these are not groups of people. Every person functions in all of them. Every person is a member of some family, is born of some parents, is a member of some state, probably of some worship institution. Every person engages in business, unless, of course, they decide to become a hermit. If they go out and live in the woods absolutely solitary and survive, then they become, you remember Aristotle's opinion of them, they're not humans. They're either animals or they're gods. They're either subhuman or they're superhuman. But aside from their relations to society, they can't be actually human. And he advised banning them from any state. Now, is this individualist or collectivist? Well, see, there can be equal versions of the hierarchical view. You could have a view that what the primary authority in the state are the individuals who vote, so the primary authority is here, and by their vote they confer that authority on the officials of the state, and after that the state's supreme over all the other institutions and individuals. So you can have a hierarchical view that's a democracy. The individual citizens all get to vote. That's the fundamental authority. The people that they elect then, if they carry out the policies that they promise to, have the authority of the people conferred on them, and they head the state, and the state rules everything hierarchy from the top down. Or you might have a version of this that's not democratic at all. Here are the individuals, the bottom. They're on the bottom rung of society. They are not the primary authority. The primary authority is carried on here in the state itself. And if the state's a monarchy, then it's carried on by having the next nearest relative to the king who just died become the new ruler, king or queen. And the people don't elect that person. That person is king by the rule of having it be genetic succession. They're the closest living relative. They step into the throne. And in medieval society, then the church consecrated the king and put the church's approval on that. So it might be authority is vested in the state itself and authority is top down, or it might be a democratic version and the authority is from the bottom up, conferred on the state, and then the rule is top down. But if you've got a hierarchical view of society, the rule is from the state, that the state rules everything. If you have, however, a view of society that says there are multiple interests and aspects to human life, every individual lives in all of these in some respect, however little. Someone may say, I don't have any religion, ignorant of the definition of religious belief, and they don't participate in any institution having to do with faith. They can do that. They still have some religious belief. Or they can say, I'm against all education. I'm not going to send my kids to school. But they're not against all education just because they don't send their kids to school, because they teach them to do things at home. They learn to farm, or they learn to drive the tractor, or they learn some skill. Everyone has some economic interest. They can't avoid that very well. They can't say, I don't want any money and I don't need it, and I'll live entirely without it, and you won't last very long at that, and so on. But then what's the relation of all these authorities? And Kuiper says that they are all endowed on humans by God, that the one real source of authority in life is God, the absolute authority. And then God gives specific authorities to the owner of business, the parents and the family, the clergy and the church, and so on. And that each one of these authorities then is confined to the specific respect that the institution was created to promote and preserve. So the authority of the church, it has to do with faith. A church can make the rules for membership in the church. It does not make the rules for what can be legal or illegal in the state. And it doesn't make the rules for businesses, families, hospitals, labor unions, political parties, and so on. Each of these kinds of authorities are delimited to their own sphere. There's a particular economic sphere of authority, an educational one, faith one in justice, health, art, and family life. Each of these kinds of authority delimits itself and distinguishes itself from all the rest. So what I'm going to do now is redraw the Kuiper view. And this is a view that came to be called sphere sovereignty. That is, the authority in each of these spheres of life, and here again is the individual who lives life in all of them at the same time, but the authority in each is limited to its own sphere. So that means that when it comes to justice, the authority of the state, which is the institution that we create to promote and preserve justice, the authority of the state is limited to matters of public justice. The state should not make laws that regulate people's faith or the economy or how parents raise children. It's not within the purview of the state to say when children should go to bed. That's the authority of the parents and the family that should say that. If you understand, these different authorities all coexist. Everybody lives in all of them at the same time. And each one has a specific social sphere in which it is the authority. And it should not overstep its prescribed bounds and attempt to butt in and usurp the authority in a different sphere of a different authority. And that's what this term came to represent. Each one sovereign, make the rules for its own sphere. So again, we have things like justice. We have an economic side to life. We are concerned with educating the young, passing on knowledge, skills, and trades. We have an interest in health, and we have an interest in faith, most people. And let's say this other one is I got health. Okay, I'm not going to worry about that. Take a look at this again. Church, mosque, synagogue. And here we create the state. Here businesses. Unions, schools, hospitals, clinics, emergency services, and so on. Let me give you an example of what would violate sphere sovereignty. I read a book not long ago about men whose parents were Greek immigrants to the United States. And they moved near Detroit, Michigan, where his father got a job with the Ford Motor Company. And in this book, this fellow remembers how the Ford Motor Company treated his family. They were very grateful to have work. They had a good wage. They had good working conditions, relatively good. But representatives of the company came around to their home. And the company representative said, when they opened the door, they stepped in, "What's that smell? That's not American food. That we smell something strange. Stop eating that stuff and eat like an American." And this way of decorating the living room, this is an American. Get rid of this and this and this and replace it with, and they made a list of what they should get. And they went through and revamped their whole lives. I don't recall them saying that you can't be members of the Orthodox Church, but it's about the only thing they didn't do. The way they carried on, entertained or visitors, for example. The food they'd serve, the way the house was decorated, the clothes they wore. And they advised them, send your kids to the public school. They've got to learn English. Don't send them to Greek-speaking school, or they're going to be foreigners all their lives. Now, that is an instance of wildly overstepping the bounds of a business. A business can tell its employees what they do while they're at work for them, what job it is they're going to be paid for. And in some businesses, it is true that you have to dress a certain way to be acceptable in meeting representatives of other businesses. That's less true now than it ever was, but there's still some of that. Okay, that comes under the company rules. When I'm in my home, what I wear, if anything, is none of their business. And that's what sphere sovereignty says. Take another example. Take the example of child labor. This is something that was addressed by unions, in fact. But my grandfather went to work when he was 5 years old in the coal mines in Pennsylvania. We established, that is, the state passed child labor laws. And a lot of the people that supported the child labor laws were, in fact, in favor of those laws because they thought that childhood should be a time for playing and having fun and being carefree and not having the great responsibility of trying to earn the family's living and so on. Now, I agree there should be child labor laws, but not for that reason. My reason is that it violates the sphere sovereignty of the family, and that's what we put over here, human reproduction, I put. Our sexual nature is the source of marriage. And there, the state undertakes to protect children from being exploited. Let me explain this point if it's not clear to you. It doesn't just mean that kids, when they're 4 or 5, may be forced to work in a coal mine. It's not just that. It's very often it was worse. A company would say to some poor immigrant trying to establish and support his family, "You want this job? it's yours provided you bring your kids along and they work for nothing. That was done a lot in the garment district in New York, where they tell women that showed up to sew dresses and sew seamstresses, it's easy for you to say. They tell a woman that you want this job, you bring your four kids and they help you. They get the clothes, the bolt of cloth, and they put it up to your machine, and the others throw the scraps over here, and this one will do this and that, and they don't get paid. You want the job? Bring them along. They work for nothing. You got the job. And the job was often 7 days a week. So in that case, what that kind of a business practice does is interfere with the family life of the children. It interferes with their education, and it interferes with their faith. They can't go to worship. It doesn't matter whether that's the seventh day, the sixth day, the fifth day, the first day, they can't have off to go to worship. Now, in Kuyper's view, whose responsibility is it to see to it that all these different spheres are kept and preserved against interference from others? It's the view, it's part of the duties of the state. Try not to laugh. I know, and he knew, that very often it's the state that violates this the worst. They get to making laws that you can or must wear certain clothing, or you can't go here and you can't do that, and it has nothing to do with public justice. So the state has to exercise great restraint on itself and be the policeman that makes sure that no other of these spheres, the authorities in these spheres, interfere with any other. And we'll drop that for now and pick it up, finish it next time.